Thank you. All right, everyone. Without further ado, we have Bob M. from Laguna Beach.
Hi, my name is Bob Martin. I'm an alcoholic. Usually I say I wasn't asked if they were recording, but I was asked if they were recording. And while they're recording, I'm really amazed that you guys get 20,000 people in this room, for those of you listening to the recording. I'm the kind of alcoholic that, I am completely clothed in immense love and fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We went to dinner, probably 20 of us, this evening. What? You're already talking about me? I'm just sitting up here. Gosh, RB's just picking on me. I mean, I tell you. and we had a great time. By the way, RB is not the one that I feel clothed in love from. I'm only kidding. He's a good friend of mine. You guys know RB. Because we went to dinner tonight, a bunch of guys that I used to sponsor, a bunch of guys that they sponsor, and some friends, and we just had a fun time. I mean, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. It's about living a life of, you know, love and peace and joy, and that's what tonight was for me. And all of these guys have come up to me and remind me to tell the truth, as well as thank me and all kinds of stuff. You know, just Alcoholics Anonymous is a phenomenal. There's nothing like it in the world that I have found. If you're new, this is really a great place to be. And you're going to find that out if you stick around. And for me, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous one night. I was driving down. I was living on a couch in Highland Park. And if you don't know where that is, it's you go down Figueroa until you hear gunfire, and then you pull in this guy's driveway. And that's where I was living. And I had, prior to that, been a bodyguard in Beverly Hills for many years. And because I qualify expert in all weapons that I fired. And I was a black belt in three martial arts and third degree black belt. And I used to hurt people for a living. That's what I did. And I was driving down Figueroa one night, drunk, and LAPD pulled me over, and they took me to the drunk tank in Parker Center, which is about the size of this room, and it's got a concrete bench all the way around it, and over in one corner is a bank of phones, and over in the other corner is a bank of toilets, and they're always in the open. That's what I love about jail. Toilets are always in the open, and everyone wants to have a conversation with you while you're sitting on there or while you're wiping or whatever. It's a lot of fun, really crappy. And it was filled with people that were just derelict, the drunks, and just terrible people. And I don't know what you would do, but being a black belt and being a person that used to hurt people for a living, I went over to the phone and I called my mom. And I said, "Mom, I'm in jail. I don't like jail. The toilet's in the open. Can you help me and get here as quickly as possible?" And she sent down my brother, who was an LAPD SWAT, and he called the watch commander before he came down. And he, forgive me for drinking a lot of water. I'm dry mouth from some meds I take, but he loves it when I'm in pain, I'm telling you. Anyway, he came down and called the watch commander, made sure that I had a fun time in there. And for those of you who haven't read the book because you're waiting for the movie, I had a thing called Pitiful and Incomprehensible Demoralization, and it was not a lot of fun. And I decided I don't like jail. And I did everything I could the next day to get out of jail, which for me, if I backtrack just a bit, for a year prior to this, I had been going to what's called EAP, which was an employee assistance person, and they had just started it. And I came to duty, I was a supervisor in the paramedic business, and we handled 10 cities up in the San Fernando Valley. And I would come on duty at 5 o'clock in the morning. Hey, tough guy, how you doing? Yeah, good to see you. That's a story, boy, I could go for an hour on that one. Good to see you. Would come to work about 4:30 in the morning, and I'd get a verbal briefing as to where about 18 or 20 ambulances were, and I'd be going, and they'd leave. And I'd come to work drunk, you know, and I'd forget where half the ambulances were. And, you know, I'd send, you know, there's an ambulance sitting right here, and the call's right here, and I'd send an ambulance from way over here to that call. And, you know, then I'd come up with a real good excuse why I didn't use that vehicle, because, you know, they had to be there for another emergency that might be coming in or whatever. And God only knows how many people I've injured or further hurt or even killed because of forgetting where ambulances were and such. And I came into work one day, and I smelled like booze, and the outgoing supervisor wrote me up, and that's when they sent me to this thing. The chief called me in, and the chief said, listen, you're either going to this or you're fired. And that's when I started going to this EAP guy. They said, we've never done this before. We don't know what it is. We don't know if it's going to work, but you're going to go to this. And the guy had 16-year sobriety. I didn't know that. And he would just sit there and listen to me for an hour and say, yeah, I understand. If I had your problems, I'd drink too. I get it. Yeah, I understand. And he was always just, you know, being Mr. Nice Guy with me the whole time. I didn't get anything out of it, you know, listening to him. And, you know, I mean, he didn't really hand me anything or tell me what to do or nothing. So I think, well, you might try this, might try this. I'm not listening to that. And I'll tell you another thing. Probably 6 years before I got sober, I was selling gaskets up in La Habra. And there was this little family company right next door to where I sold gaskets. And I used to go over there and drink with the son of the owner, the husband and wife team that owned it, and their two sons worked there. And I'd go over and drink with the youngest son, and we'd hang out on the weekends and go to Dodger games and stuff. And we just, you know. And by the way, if you're new, I drank, smoked, pop, shot, did all of that stuff. However, I'm going to talk about alcohol only because I believe in the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it doesn't matter that it's a big part of my story. I can take that out of the story and just talk about alcohol. And as my first sponsor said to me, Bob, when you say alcohol, you can include all that other stuff, you know, the drugs and all that stuff and the sheep and that kind of stuff. And we haven't got there yet. So I'm getting ahead of myself. So and I'm going over there every Friday night drunk with a case of beer and you know, just smoked one. And, you know, and I'm, you know, waiting for his son. And I would sit there and make fun of the guy that owned the place, the dad, because his card had his home phone number on it. And I said, why do you have your home phone number on it? They were a tube company. They put, you know, just, you know, tubes together and stuff, and put, you know, the ends of tubes together and stuff. And I said, what, do you get emergency overnight calls for tubes or something? And he goes, no. He says, that's for people that have drinking problems, Bob. He said, and they might want some help. So I you know, my phone number's on there, and they can call me any time of the night, and I respond to them. He says, do you think you have a drinking problem? I said, no, I don't have a drinking problem. I drink, I fall down, I get up. And I thought that was really funny, and I just made it up. But he had heard it like 1,000 times, obviously, as you guys did, because nobody laughed there. And the name of this company was called Alpi Industries. And I got to know this guy really well. But I never, ever, ever did I hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous from him. He was saying it. Guy's name was Norm Alpi. If you're an old guy, if you're around, if you're an old person, you know this guy. He used to be a circuit speaker, and him and Chuck. And, you know, years later, I got a call from his son to come up and help him get sober. So I got to pay back some of the conversations that I don't remember that he and I had. So I got arrested, called my mom, had a pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization while I was in the jail. The next morning, to look good to the judge, I called my EAP and asked him and said, what should I do? And he said, well, why don't you admit yourself to Valley Presbyterian Hospital for their 30-day program? So I did. And I did that ostensibly to look good for the judge. Now, I tell you that because there's people in Alcoholics Anonymous that say that you can't be here for your wife, and you can't be here for your son, or you can't be here for your job, and you can't. That's bullshit. So the book says, and my book says, the only requirement is a desire to stop drinking. Now, if you're here and you have a desire to stop drinking, and you're like me, I hated God. I thought God was a total dick, that he killed children, and I was in the business, you know, in the ambulance business, and I'd come to a scene and people were dead, and I'd tap dance on their chest, or I'd jump start them, and I'd bring them back to life. You know, I was much greater than God. I mean, you know, oh, little guy. And that he killed children, too. That was terrible. Why does he do that? I'd go to scenes and there, you know, kids were dead and stuff, and that was just, I'd blame those on God. And so when I came here, my first sponsor used to consistently tell me that there is a God and you're not it, Bob. That's all you got to remember. And I didn't have a good feeling of God when I first came here. And there's something I didn't know. When I came here, I had a desire to stop drinking, to look good to the judge for a little while. I wasn't going to stop drinking forever. I was just going to stop drinking long enough for this 502, this drunk driving thing to go away. And they didn't have lots of recovery places like they do now and stuff. And by the way, my sobriety date is October 12th, 1985. My home group is the Wednesday night men's stag step study in Laguna Beach, and the Tuesday night men's stag newcomers meeting at the South Coast. And that's why I say Laguna Beach. RB was on me and said, you're not from Laguna Beach. You live in San Clemente. So just to be correct, I live in San Clemente. But my home meetings, that's where I identify with, is my home meeting. So, oh boy, I just went into a cul-de-sac, which I'm going to do quite often during this conversation. And I'm going to forget where I was. So then somebody's going to have to say where I was. I don't remember where the hell I was. Huh? So I want to look good to the judge. Get a 5 bucks. Thanks, Paul. Paul, guess what? You're now on tape. Oh. And TJ. Okay, all right. Levi. Okay, there you go. So I just to look good to the judge, I went to this thing, and as I stuck around in the hospital, I was there. When I got in there, there was 48 of us, and we would do group. You know, a lot of them were what do you call it, outside, and would come in for the day. I don't know what you call that, but and then outpatient, and then a lot of us were inpatient. They were locked in there, and we couldn't leave. And there's 48 of us. And one time, when I had about 14 days, this guy left, and this guy was his third time in the hospital, and he left. And I thought, this was my thinking, I had heard everybody's story in there. Everybody had worse reasons for you know, they had much worse problems than I had, so they had much better reasons for getting sober than I did. And I thought that they understood it far greater than I understood it. I didn't even know the Lord's Prayer. When we would say the Lord's Prayer, I would stand up and go, because I knew everybody was looking at me. So I had to mumble, you know, and make sure that it looked like I was saying it. And took me like 3 or 4 months. Then they switched it and called the Serenity Prayer. What? Come on. Well, you're supposed to call the Lord's Prayer. Everybody knows that. Anyway, so I was in this hospital, and the guy went out and called 4 hours later, drunk off his ass, begging to come back into the hospital. And they wouldn't let him in because their policy was you had to be away for so many weeks or something like that. And I was amazed. I mean, this guy tried three times to get sober, and he called back in 4 hours. It was unbelievable. It never ceases to amaze me the strength and power of the disease of alcoholism and how it calls us from the top shelf, and that length of sobriety does not equate security. That's why I'm up here talking tonight, and that I would never turn down an invitation to speak, no matter what my physical function is. And thank you, Kathleen, for inviting me to speak. And while I was in there, first 30 days, we went from 48 down to 35. 60 days, you know, we went down to 25. 90 days, we went down to 15. 1 year, we went down to 7. 5 years, we went down to 3. 10 years, we went down to 2. And to my knowledge, I'm the only one left out of that group. Now, I don't know if any of those people came back and later on got sober. I just know that I never heard from them or saw them again after they had gone out. And this is a deadly disease. My good friend, Bobby Davis, you're on tape, and he loves to point out at our step study on Wednesday night that it says in the book that, you know, this is a life and death deal. I'm not up here to scare the heck out of you, because it's actually, you can't scare an alcoholic. In fact, I didn't care if I died. I actually wanted to die. I just was not suicidal, because I couldn't do that. I didn't have the huevos to do that. So, but if I died, you know, if I ran out of the house with a fake gun in my hand when the cops come up, that'd be okay, you know, or something like that. Anyway, so when I was arrested for the 502. I went to the hospital. They put me in that section, and I watched all these people stop staying sober. And they would do it by not going to meetings and not having a sponsor and things like that. And, you know, they talk about it all the time at the meetings I was at, that you should have a sponsor, you got to get a sponsor. So finally, I'm watching this one guy, and I'm really afraid, you know. And what the fear is in me, I now know, was the fear of rejection. So finally, though, I asked this guy, will you be my sponsor? And he says no. And I'm devastated. Takes me a couple more weeks. I asked the next guy, you know, would you be my sponsor? He said no. And I went through 5 guys, and they said no. And so I was at this meeting, and it was a mixed meeting. Like, this was a speaker meeting. I heard somebody share that I let the meeting be my sponsor. And I thought, that's pretty cool. I'll let the meeting be my sponsor. Now, I had never stood still like this before in a certain section, because I was always moving around from couch to couch. And now I'm staying in one place, and all my bills and credit card stuff that I had, this wave of debt came over me. And I was working in the ambulance business, and the paycheck that I was making was barely paying the interest. It wasn't touching any of the principal. So I was going nowhere. And I'm about 3 months sober, and I just read the book, Beat the Dealer and How to Win at 21, and I came to a conclusion that God was on my side, and He wants to help me. That's why He had me read this book. So I'm going to take my paycheck, and I'm going to go to Vegas. So I went to the meeting, the men's stag, and there's 100 guys in there, and I said, this is what I'm going to do. And 99 guys said, don't go, you'll probably drink. And one of them said, go, you might win. So I used them as my sponsor, so I went, you know. And I lost all the money. I didn't drink, even though it was all free booze. And God has a sense of humor. It just flashed on me. My mom, when I had about a year and a half, she got all the family together, and we were gonna fly up to San Francisco. And she had the hotels for all my brothers and sisters. And I have 2 brothers and a sister, and I'm the baby. I'm the 4th one born. And so she flew us all up for this thing. And as we're taking off on the jet, in Burbank Airport, the plane all of a sudden puts back down, and you hear the engines in reverse, and he stopped at the end of the runway. And he comes over and he says, ladies and gentlemen, we had some indicated lights I didn't really like. We're checking something. We'll be with you in a few moments. And we're there for about a half hour. And I look at my mom and I go, damn. And she goes, what? I said, they're going to bring out free drinks. Believe it. That's what they do. So they ended up having us come off of this plane and go on to another plane. They took off, and as soon as they took off, they brought out the cart, and it was free drinks for everybody. And so I drank, I think it's Diet Coke at that time. Really smart thing to drink. At any rate, which is, by the way, worked really well, Diet Coke. Yeah. And so, but I got one thing working for me. I only need a cup of water when I take a bath. So just get in the bathtub, one cup of water, it disperses all over the spot. I got that going for me. Conserve a lot of water. So God just has a sense of humor, I think, constantly. So I get sober, right? I'm in this hospital. They start dragging us to men's stags. We go to these men's stags. Finally, I get this guy to be my sponsor. He was actually a movie writer, a comedy movie writer. He was almost as funny as I am, I thought, and he was almost as good looking as me, and he was almost as smart as me. And as soon as I asked him to be my sponsor, he turned into a dick overnight. It was unbelievable. You know, one of his favorite things to do was this all the time during the meeting. You know, I'd be at a meeting and they ask him for shares, and I'd put my hand up and he'd go, "You don't have anything to share. Shut up." And I can remember when I was getting up to go have a cigarette and he went, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to go have a cigarette." He said, "No, sit down. While you're outside, you might miss the miracle that is going to happen for you here in this meeting while you're outside having a cigarette, and you'll miss it." So he said, "What I want you to do is you take a piss before the meeting, and you take a cigarette before the meeting, and you don't get up and go out of a meeting ever during the meeting. I don't care how long the meeting is." I said, "Okay." And one time I was at this, he actually set up my meetings, which was six men's stags a week, and then we got this one mixed meeting. And I was at this mixed meeting one time, and how us alcoholics are, how when we're saying the Lord's Prayer, we want to get attention, alcoholics do. And this one guy, was waiting for that one moment where there's just like a little gap, and when you say, "Deliver us from evil," he yelled out, right when it was silent after that, "Deliver us from ego." And everybody laughed, and I thought that was pretty good. So I went to the men's stag, and I'm sitting there, and I'm ready for the opening. And I go, "Okay, and deliver us from ego." And my sponsor didn't even let go of my hand. He hit me in the back of the head. I don't know how he did it. And he said, "I'll deliver you from ego." He said, "Who the hell are you to change a prayer that's been around for over 2,000 years? He says, "And just because you're a stupid idiot, I'm going to explain it to you." He said, "The fact that you're saying deliver us from ego is an act of ego." So that's like going into a bank and saying, "Deliver me from robbing banks as I rob this bank." I mean, you got to meet him halfway here, pal. So don't change the thing and just, leave it the way it is. It's been around for 2,000 years. I said, "Well, that's the guy that did it. Why don't you go hit him?" I was sitting at a meeting and I'm sitting there listening to the guy talk, one of the guys with time, and all of a sudden my sponsor hit me in the back of the head. I said, "What?" He said, "I know what you're thinking." And I thought he did. He'd say stuff like, I go, "Wow, how did you know that?" We'd go outside after the meeting, a sharing meeting kind of thing, and we'd go outside and he'd go, "Wow, did you hear RB? Wasn't he just, wow, he was phenomenal. He said this and that." And I go, "Are you kidding? That guy's a dick. Did you hear what he said? That stuff was terrible." And then he said, "No, he said this and this and this." And I'm like, "What meeting were you at? I didn't hear him say any of that." Because I couldn't hear the message. I couldn't hear the positive stuff. Because the book talks about it. I was in the negative stuff. I was only listening for the negative stuff. Yeah. Okay. This is a bad group up front. I'm going to hit them. All right. I wish I had some water to spray on them. Anyway. What? Am I not supposed to say anything? Okay. I got RB up here. He's telling me he's giving me crap. I tell you. All right. So Where the hell was I there? That was a cul-de-sac mountain.
RV.
Yeah, I was talking about RV. So, I don't know where the hell I was, but finally, at any rate, this sponsor keeps pushing the big book on me. I keep complaining to him about my financial problems. You don't know. I'm still in the ambulance business. I'm still a supervisor. And you don't know the problems I have. And he'd say, okay, read this book. And I'd push it away and I go, you don't understand. The answers aren't in there. This is the problem. And that's what I was going to say. And the big book talks about how we shift from negative thinking to positive thinking. And when you're new, at least when I was new, I was a negative thinker and all I could hear was the negative stuff. I couldn't hear the positive stuff. Now, years later, I'm going to jump ahead real fast for 1 second. Years later, because of a guy that's in this room by the name of Kyle, I ended up with a job working for the number one motivational speaker in the world, and I worked out of San Diego, lived here in Dana Point, and I drove down to San Diego every day. And I went all over the world with this guy and all that kind of stuff. And he understood the matrix of the brain. There was only about 5 people in the world that understand the matrix of the brain as well as this guy does. And how we think and why we think and why we do stuff and all that kind of deal. And who knows? It was going to be good. I don't know. Tony, yeah, well, Tony doesn't believe in AA. That's true. He doesn't, but and that's all right. I let him not, you know, I don't have to make him understand that AA works. He went to a couple meetings and he thought it was all negative and just people talking negative stuff. He didn't understand how when we talk about, you know, somebody shares at a meeting how, you know, my father died and everybody laughs, you know, or shares some kind of terrible thing that happened in their life and we're all laughing about it, and the humor in AA. He just didn't understand that stuff. Any rate, I go to work for this guy, and it was the best job I ever had. I got to travel around the world and speak to all kinds of people, and that was because of being in sobriety. It was all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was all because I sponsored a guy named Kyle who called me every morning at 7:30 in the morning because it was a 28-day interview, 15-hour days. One of the things we had to do was jump out of a plane at 15,000 feet. One of the things they did was take us at midnight in the middle of nowhere, 400 miles away, and we had to find our way back down to San Diego. They took everything from us and gave us a packet of almonds and a quarter and a little, in case we had to make a phone call, and a little disposable camera so that we took pictures of our trip. And we were supposed to do this on our rapport skills that he had taught us. And it was an amazing, amazing job. And the people that I got to meet, and it was all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was all because of that guy, Kyle. Because every morning I'd tell him, I can't do this. These guys are all smarter than me. I don't have a memory. They can do things I can't do. I've got a cracked skull. You know, I took a knife in the back when I was a bodyguard. I only got one lung. I can't do this. I don't know. And he'd say, yeah, you can. You can go in there. You can do it. One more day. Go in there. And I'd go in there. And by God, you know, I got through the thing. You know, and there was like about 40 people in the beginning, and in the end there was 11 of us, and they got hired. And God, I love that job. And I one day got a phone call from my mom, and she had fallen in her house, and it took her. She lived in Dana Point. She had fallen, and it took her 4 hours to crawl to the phone. Now I had been with my mom 3 months prior when we went to the doctors, and she was told that she had cancer for the third time. First time they did a one mastectomy, second time they did a second mastectomy, third time she said, I'm not going to do anything. We're just going to let it run its course. And she called me 3 months. They said, well, you got about 6 months to live. And she called me 3 months into it. And I did what you people taught me to do. I took my headphone off and I said, Mom, I'll be there as fast as I can. And I'm walking out the place, and Tony says, "Where are you going?" I said, "My mom's sick, and I'm going to go take care of her." And I drove up here, and they wanted me to continue doing the job for them from my house, and I just didn't see that as a good thing to do. And I spent 24/7 with my mom, and as an alcoholic, I was giving her liquid morphine. And it was in a little eyedropper. And in the beginning, I would give her like a little bit of eyedropper for 4 hours. And by the end, I was giving her a full eyedropper every 20 minutes. And in the end, she went into unconsciousness. And I thought I did that. I thought that I did that because I'm a more guy. I like to give more. And I don't think there's excuse me. But one should never have Italian food before you talk. I love Sonny's, but what can you do? I thought that I had, you know, progressed this thing, and that she went into a unconsciousness because of me and the amount of drugs that I was giving her. And the doctor told me, "Oh no, it's not you. Don't you worry about that." And despite him saying that, I continuously thought that. Then she died one day, and I thought that I progressed her death. And I said that to the doctor, and he said, "No, you didn't do that." He said, "Besides, even if you did," now, I'm an alcoholic. He just said, "Even if you did," which meant to me that I did. And he said, "Even if you did do that, she's in a better place." So what I just heard is I cut her 2 or 3 days short from living here on earth. And I took that with me for a couple of years and went into a dark spot. And my friends from AA would come to my house, and I had all the, you know, windows draped and closed and everything, and I'd just be watching movies and didn't want to do anything. Because I also lost my job because I took 3 months, you know, taking care of my mom. When I went back to work, I didn't have any clients anymore. So after about being there for a week, they terminated me. And for other reasons, too. He was divorcing his wife, and it was a big deal kind of thing. Anyway, so half the people went with the wife and blah, blah. But I lost a job that I loved more than anything in the world. However, I took care of my mom. 2 brothers and a sister. I'm the one that stayed there and did that. None of them did it. They didn't volunteer. They stayed with their life. You know why? Because Alcoholics Anonymous taught me to do that. And you know why? Because none of those guys do the 12, my 2 brothers and my sister, don't know the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. They don't know the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. They don't know that we're supposed to pick up the responsibility. And that we're supposed, and you know, when I was a kid, I was 8 years old, my 2 brothers showed me in print that every 4th child born in the world was Chinese, so most of my life I thought I was Chinese. And that's probably why I'm an alcoholic today, but, you know, I think it's more along the lines that when I was in 3rd grade, the teacher asked everybody, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And people were saying, fireman, policeman. And I said, "I want to be President of the United States." Well, I was born in London, England. And I'm 100% Irish, so I get up every morning and I beat the crap out of myself. But at any rate, I said, "I want to be President of the United States." And she said, "Oh, you can't be President of the United States because you weren't born on American soil. You're not an American. You've got to be an American to be President of the United States." And she saw the droopiness just go over my face like, "Oh, my God, my life is over," 3rd grade. And she said, "Well, you could be Vice President." And I'm an alcoholic. I don't want to be number 2. That is. At 3rd grade, I thought, that's a stupid idea. I don't want to be number 2. Jeez, if I can't be number 1, I'm not going to do it. And that was the way I was. You know, I wouldn't go do this sport or that sport because I'd have to be excellent at it before I started. If I'm not going to be excellent right out of the gate, I don't want to do it. And I didn't understand that, you know, consistency, you know, is the... repetition is the mother of skill, and that I, you know, could get better only by doing it over and over again. So I got this sponsor. He walks me through these steps, and he says the first step is probably the most important one, Bob, for you to understand, and it's something actually that you do daily, if not hourly, if not every minute, that you that your life is unmanageable, and that you're powerless over alcohol. And I listened when they read a portion of chapter 3 and 5. And I listened when they say that through all forms of self-deception and experimentation, that means that I'm going to believe my own baloney. I'm going to tell myself that it's okay for me to go do this thing, whatever it is. And that I can't trust me is what it is. And that's why I need a sponsor. Because he's my bullshit filter. He's the guy that when I tell him, you know, hey, I won this trip to Vegas, he knows, no, you're not going to Vegas. No. I don't care if it's a free trip. It's not going to be a free trip. I was flying into New York about 4 years, 3 years ago, and for some business, and I made the return flight with a stopover in Houston because my best friend lived in Houston. I hadn't seen him in a couple of years, and the business was concluded. I called my sponsor on my daily call, and I said, "Yeah, I'm going to stop in Houston on the way back for a couple of days." And then I went. He said, "What?" Now I had at this time 23 years. 24 years. And he said, I said, "What?" He said, "What?" He said, "I'm going to stop at Houston." He says, "You're not going to stop at Houston. You don't have any money. You can't afford that. You can't afford, where are you going to stay? How are you going to afford a hotel? You don't have any money for food. What are you going to do?" And I went, I'm a little overly optimistic, by the way. So he said, "I want you to change that flight right now to direct flight to back to L.A. And I said, "But that'll cost money anyway. That'll cost me $150. He said, "That's much less than what it would have cost you to go to Houston for 2 days. 24 years. So I did what he told me to do. Length of sobriety does not equate security. I still have to talk to my sponsor on a daily basis. I call my sponsor on a daily basis. I don't necessarily talk to him on a daily basis if he's busy. He says he'll call me back, or I'll leave a message saying everything's hunky-dory. If I need to talk to him, though, I'll say, "Please call me," and he will. The other thing that I need, you know, there's a triangle in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's unity, service, and recovery. And service is what you do at a meeting. You know, you come help set up, or you come tear down, or you, where's Val? Where did we go? There he is. Okay. Happy birthday. 10 years. It's awesome. Get another 10 years. You can drink Dos Equis if you're like reading the book at the time. Get volunteer to do stuff like that. Volunteer to clean the room up. My sponsor taught me. So when they asked for volunteers, I'd have my hand up. Anytime they wanted to volunteer for this or that, I always had my hand up. And one day I got a year. And my sponsor's sitting next to me, and they asked for volunteers, and I put my hand up, and he hit me. And I said, "What?" He said, "You know, you got a year now." He said, "You don't need to be advertising to everybody that you're cleaning up." He said, "And besides, if you put your hand up, one of the newcomers won't put their hand up. So you just don't put your hand up. You stick around and help clean up. You don't have to get a big fanfare and all that kind of stuff." He taught me that to do things to help people without letting anyone know, which is very difficult to do. And he said, if you tell anybody about it, it takes away the points. He talked to me about points. He said, going to a meeting, talking to your sponsor, these are points, and you're putting them into a bank account, because there'll come a day when it's just you and the drink and the booze, and you better have enough. You better have enough money in your bank account to cover your ass, otherwise you're going to drink. Now, my old boss used to say, Tony used to say, people do things for only two reasons in this world: distance themselves from pain or in the pursuit of pleasure. And people come into Alcoholics Anonymous, especially nowadays, because the pain of drinking or using is greater than the pain of not drinking or using, because they've got, like, you know, jail time, or the parents are kicking them out and they have to live on the streets, or whatever it is. And then after a certain period of time, if you have not taken the steps or worked the steps or started with a sponsor or started on your change from a negative to a positive thinker, what will happen is the pain of not drinking will become greater than the pain of drinking. and you will drink again. Because booze is not my problem. That's the solution to my problem. My problem is me. My problem is me constantly. I have 26 days, 5 months, and 27 years. I'm sitting there. RB comes over to Bobby and says, Bobby, come here, I need to talk to you. And he goes away with Bobby, and I think, they're talking about me. He took him away because, now you're shaking your head, yeah, he was. Okay. So I'm thinking, you know, okay, it's something about me. He's talking to him about that. Because that's the kind of alcoholic I am. Now, I got to tell you, for me, this whole thing has been an ongoing process. And they used to talk about this. It's kind of like an onion, and you can only see the outside layer. And you go, oh, yeah, that's my problem. And you peel off that outside layer. And then, oh, then I see the next layer. That's the problem. And then you peel that off. And it's just a continuation of discovering, and discarding. Thank you. I'm the kind of guy you say hello to, and I'm stumped for an answer. So it doesn't matter. 6 years ago, I was diagnosed with cancer. I was told that I have a year to live. They gave me an operation. In the operation, they cut me open from here to here, and it wouldn't close. And I was in bed in my house in San Clemente and having a nurse come once a day to redo the wound thingies, dealy bobbies. And they didn't think it was going to close. It took a year and a half, and finally it closed. Now, because I went through the chemo and the radiation, ended up killing a lot of my organs and stuff. So I stand in front of you right now with 40% of one kidney working, half of a liver working, one lung. By the way, I have no asshole. It's gone because the radiation fried it. So by the way, anything I say is not opinion. It's fact. Yeah, right. You get those old timers get that. And many other different, you know, things missing internally with me. Scar tissue everywhere. My plumbing doesn't work very good. I have it's actually a really good thing. I have a poop bag up front because I'm so fat now I can't reach around and wipe my butt anyway. So good that I have that. And that's a good thing. Got that working for me. I'll tell you another thing is that it was Alcoholics Anonymous that got me through this. Because if it wasn't for the humor and making it fun, I would have my head way up my tail, and I would have died in that 1 year. Three times in my 6 years, they told me that I have 1 year to live. I'm on a 1 year right now. I'm 6 months into 1 year right now. And they tell me that if I drop, my kidney drops less than 40%, they'll put me on dialysis. And at that time, I'll have less than 9 months to live because dialysis is not a permanent solution to the problem. I'm not supposed to be standing in front of you. You know, I was in bed for 2 years, couldn't get out of bed. RB would come over and pound on the door, and I'd run to the door to open it up because somebody locked it. And, you know, there was a pretty big mess from the bed to the door and back. Blood and stuff, and he'd come over and visit me, and Bobby would come over and visit me, and friends in Alcoholics Anonymous would come over and visit me and take meetings to my bed. The only thing that got me through this thing is Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing that gets me through it is Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you why. Because I was feeling really bad when they told me that, and I had only a year to live. On my sixth day of feeling really bad and feeling terrible and how life sucks and God's a bum, Bobby Davis calls me up and says, you know, Bob, he said, maybe you have this because so you can show others how to walk through cancer sober and that you could be an example for other people. And maybe that's what this is about. And I took that. I framed that as why I have cancer and what it's about. It's to be an example to people, to show people that you can stay sober taking medications and that make you forget things and make you have go into, you know, cul-de-sacs as you're talking. And just, if it wasn't for Bobby Davis, I would have been probably dead. I would have just been, you know, given up and died, curled up and died in that 1 year. It's friends like that in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I got to sponsor people in Alcoholics Anonymous. That is just a gift. And one of the things about sponsorship is I get more out of it than they do. I can remember a day when I used to sponsor TJ. You're on tape now. And we were sitting in front of one of the guys he sponsored, and we were talking back and forth so fast about Alcoholics Anonymous and the traditions and stuff, he just couldn't follow. It was like way above his head. But we were having a fun time laughing and talking over this stuff. I'm telling you, if you're new and you do not have a sponsor, you saw two perfect people to sponsor you. If you're a woman, you got Kathleen, 21 years sober. Do not leave tonight without asking her to be your sponsor if you do not have a sponsor. All right? If you're a man, no, it isn't. You have Val. He's got 10 years. Do not leave here tonight unless you ask him to sponsor you. You know why? Because you can't fix a broken thinker with a broken thinker. And as smart as I think I am, I'm a member of Mensa, guys. I'm really smart. Let me tell you how wonderful I am and how brilliant I am. By the way, I have multitudes of humble things I could tell you about, but there's not enough people in this room, and we don't have enough time left for the examples that I was going to give you of my humility. However, I always like to end with this, and it means a lot to me. It's around Alcoholics Anonymous a lot, and it says, it usually people say that it's anonymous, but it wasn't anonymous. This is a judge by the name of John Tweehy who got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. He had 3 years. It was in 1943. He was a federal judge. He was speaking at the 4th AA convention in Chicago. Sitting at this meeting was Bill Wilson, who sat at this and said, you know what, this is a good idea. We should have a world convention. Thank you. World convention. So it's tough words. World convention. And we have one every 5 years, and I implore you to go to one. They're on the 0 or the 5th. Like, it's going to be 2005, 2010, 2015, 2020. So they're on the 0 or the 5th year. Any rate, this was Judge Tweehy, and he was speaking to the people in the room, the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would say this on to you now. So if you didn't hear anything at all this evening, that's okay. If you're new, hear this right now. Listen to me now. It's called Why We Were Chosen. God in His wisdom selected this group of men and women to be purveyors of His goodness. In selecting them through whom to bring about the phenomenon, He went not to the proud, the mighty, the famous, or the brilliant. He went instead to the humble, to the sick, to the unfortunate. He went right to the drunkard, the so-called weakling of the world. Well might He have said to us, unto your weak and feeble hands I have entrusted a power beyond estimate. To you has been given that which has been denied the most learned of your fellows, not to scientists or statesmen, not to wives or mothers, not even to my priests or ministers have I given the gift of healing other alcoholics, which I entrust to you now. It must be used unselfishly. It comes with it grave responsibility. No day can be too long. No demands upon your time can be too urgent. No case be too pitiful. No task be too hard. No effort be too great. It must be used with tolerance, For I have restricted its application to no race, no creed, and no denomination. Personal criticism you must expect. Lack of appreciation will be common. Ridicule will be your lot. Your motives will be misjudged. You must be prepared for adversity, for what men call adversity is the ladder you must use to ascend the rungs towards spiritual perfection. And remember, in this exercise of this power, I shall not exact from you beyond your capabilities. You were selected because you are not selected because of exceptional talents. And be careful always, if success attends your efforts, not to ascribe to personal superiority that to which you can lay claim only by my virtue of my gift that I give to you now. If I had wanted learned men to accomplish this mission, the power would have been entrusted to the physician or the scientist. If I had wanted eloquent men, there would have been many anxious for the assignment, for talk is the easiest used of all talents with which I have endowed mankind. If I had wanted scholarly men, the world is filled with better qualified men than you who would be available. You were selected because you have been the outcast of the world. And your long experience as a drunkard has made or should make you humbly alert to the cries of distress that come from the lonely hearts of alcoholics everywhere. Keep ever in your mind the admission that you made on the day of your profession in AA, and that's namely that you are powerless, and that it was only with your willingness to turn your life and will onto my keeping that relief has come to you. There's somebody in this room that's brand new that's going to sponsor someone 10 years from now that might create the cure to the world and create peace. There might be somebody in this room that's new that's going to do that. I don't know. But I know that any time that someone's hand comes out, my hand is supposed to be there to meet them, because that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And no task is too hard. And believe me, they may light your bed on fire, they may steal your watches, they may steal your things from your home. They may hurt you. They may do all kinds of things. But we do all of that because that's what we are taught to do, to carry the message to other alcoholics. We're the only ones that can hear that. I'm a very lucky man having cancer, because when people ask me now, do I wear boxers or briefs, I say, depends. Now, if there happens to be courtesy applause at the end of this, which usually when I talk there's not, and that's, we don't have time to go into that, but if there is courtesy applause at the end of this, don't let it be for a fat old fart like me that likes to pontificate. Let it be for you, because you probably don't applaud yourself very much, and on a Friday night, right about now, you should be working on your seventh or eighth drink. And so you probably, if you're anything like me as an alcoholic, don't pat yourself on the back enough. And you should applaud yourself for being in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on a Friday night here trying to change your life. I love you all, and God loves you all. God bless.